God, grant my discernity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference.
Amen. Tonight, our 40-minute speaker is Gary C. from Laguna Niguel.
Hi, everybody. Gary, alcoholic. Look at my water going here. I grabbed a cup out there in the kitchen thinking I needed to supply for myself. I didn't know that this is kind of a Cadillac meeting here. Treat me like royalty. So good to be here. So good to be sober. So many memories. I got sober here in the 80s. The newcomers, especially. August 26, 1985, I darkened the doors of AA. I went to the Primes Park meeting. Sometime right around September 1st or thereabouts, I was outside the meeting after Friday night meeting here, and there was a guy named Bob. He used to be in the Air Force, and I learned later that he really wasn't wound very tight, or he was perhaps wound too tight. But I, you know, how mysterious this thing is when you get here, and I outside those doors right there, I said, "Gee, can you tell me about sponsorship?" And he says, "Sure, I'll sponsor you." And he goes right into the whole spiel of what he was going to do and what I had to do and everything. And I'm like, "Wait, I really wasn't asking you to sponsor me. I just want to know about it, you know." And I remember thinking, I, you know, that old adage, you know, my best thinking got me here. I remember thinking, I always insisted on doing it my way, and this is what my way got me, and maybe I need to just listen. And that man got me on my knees every morning, and had me call him every day in the evening. And at 30 days sober, I fired him. And he assured me I was going to drink. And I was so sick to my stomach about the whole thing, I went to the 10:30 meeting over at the old Friendship Center and spilled my guts about the whole thing. Some dear old lady comes up to me and had many years of sobriety and said, "Gary, don't worry. When you go to a meeting, listen to people, and when you hear somebody that has what you want, and that's the person you want to ask to be your sponsor." And that turned out to be Brian. I was talking to Fred about it, an old friend of ours, Brian, who was in Arizona back in the, I don't know, late, early 90s, I think. But anyway, that one of the blessings of my sobriety is that I went from being a hack carpenter when I got here, the first guy that they always fired, laid off, I make my living as a writer today. And that was like frost and that fork in the road. And I had gone way the fuck down that fork in the road, and, you know, to get here. And in the course of my sobriety, there was this realization that, wait a minute, all my life I loved words. I played with it. Poetry, song lyrics, writing letters, whatever, and this really burning bush kind of experience that I had, that's what I really want to do, and because of this program, I spent all these hours alone, and I tell you, there were people asking me to go to snorkeling trips to Cozumel, and I'm down in my cava, as I used to call it, in the basement of my place. Writing away, and you know, that simple discipline of working, setting a goal, working towards it, and achieving it, you know, is utterly impossible without this program. So my first sobriety date, well, I tell you that because writing is really a way to get paid for bullshitting. And so I get all of that out of my system, you know. on a piece of paper every day. So it's really kind of limited the amount of bullshitting that I do. But when I stand up here, I'm thinking, boy, I could tell you some tall tales. And I love to tell tall tales. But, you know, I got sober August 26, 1985. October 28, 1987, I'm coming to in a Mexican jail cell in San Quintin, Baja California. Anybody been to San Quintin? Anybody know it? It's a couple hundred miles below the border on the coast. If you're sober, it's a lovely little place. It's actually a lovely little place if you're a drunk. But I had totaled a car, a brand new car. And I had no idea if I had killed anybody. I had no idea if I was going to spend the next 25 years of my life in a Mexican prison paying for my sins. I knew nothing except for I was bloodied and beat up and bruised, literally and figuratively speaking. And I'm lying in a jail cell with a bunch of Mexicans talking away. I'm detoxing. There's literally piss on the floor. I am a combination of terrified, repulsed by my surroundings, and that's my hook. Okay, what happened between August 26, 1985, and October 28th? 1987 says to me so much about the nature of alcoholism and you know the nature of recovery. When I got here October 26, 1985, I was scared to death. I didn't want what I had anymore. But I was clueless. I remember so vividly being in that candlelight meeting over at the old club on, I think it's a Saturday night, I believe. And when they turn the lights out and the candles are going and, you know, you're brand new and there's all the eyes are going like this. It's like a whodunit thing, you know. Everyone's looking around, you know. And there's whispering and stuff. And when I began to write, you know, I started this tome about my experience. It's called Sober in America. And I did it, all the vignettes were done with a title. And the title of that particular vignette was Mysterious Rooms. Because, you know, it was that sense of how clueless I was about what was going on inside of here. And really how clueless I was about what was going on inside of here. You know, and the combination of those things. You know, today I can look back and say, gee, here's a practical road. The steps of recovery. If I had just looked up at the wall at the old club, and this is before Brad made them, but, you know, there's every club has those steps in the walls. If I just looked up there and really read the steps and thought about them seriously and committed them to heart and considered that my life in light of those steps, I would have been light years ahead of where I was. But, you know, I got here from banging around. My life was like a bumper car. You know, that was how I learned, from bumping into things. And remarkably, I still do that today. You know, I take pride in being able to confess my sins. It's wonderful to be, you know, that portion of chapter 5 we read. And I remember sitting in a meeting one time, and all of a sudden just a light went on. It says, you know, constitutionally incapable of being honest with ourselves, and this is fairly early on in my sobriety, and I realized, God, you know, the thing that I have to do is that, you know, at home in the privacy of my own little world, I just have to get honest with Gary. And from that, you know, I learned to get honest with you. I've come to feel very strongly that I'm not here to please anybody. I'm here to respect you. I'm here to care about you. I'm here to help you. But I don't really give a shit if you like my life or not, you know, because that's personal. You know, it's like I have to do what I have to do. I'll give you an example, and then I'll get into, you know, I was born in a log cabin crap. But I recently published one of my novels. A lot of what I do for a living is ghostwrite, and I'll tell you a little bit about that later on. But I have my own literary works, and I was published in a little company that put the novel out 7 years ago, went out of business, and I decided that, because we're never satisfied, right? You know, I make a pretty good living as a ghostwriter, but I want my stuff out there in print. So it has turned into a saga like you can't believe. I started thinking, I didn't want world's best ghostwriter etched onto my gravestone. You know, and after about 3 or 4 months of having to market your work and just dealing with the whole, promotional end of it and everything, I'm thinking, that sounds so bad after all, it was like, where you go to work, you put in your hours, you go home, and you're done. And when you get into this thing of marketing your own work, there's no end to it. But anyway, I got on the phone with Amazon, and I went to bed at 5 o'clock. I got up around noon. I got on the phone with Amazon because I had to talk to them during these certain time frames. And I'm literally eating a bowl of oatmeal at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I mean, I don't expect anybody to envy me or want my life or, think that that's a grand thing. That's just the way it is. I hear I forget your name, but one of her friends lives above me. Over on East 9, what I've learned about people as they get older, unlike me, they go to bed earlier and earlier and get up earlier and earlier, right? And I just live by inspiration, a lot of times obsession. I'll definitely talk about that, I'm working till 5 in the morning, and I hear them getting up as I'm going to sleep. And I think, God, my life is really weird. But, I'm responsible. And that's what really matters, I pay my bills. If I step on your toes and I hurt your feelings or I piss you off, I don't blow you away. I go, I'm sorry, what can I do? How can I be a better person? I'm not here to kiss your ass, but I am here to respect you. I was born actually in a clapboard house in Hartford, Connecticut, New England, and to Irish Italian parents. And so I had drama and war built into my life from a very early age, and I really love my family. A lot of them are gone. There's nothing quite like, you got the Italians doing this shot and talking, hey, what's the matter you? And then you got the Irish, and, the minute you get together, they'd start, it was inevitable. The bottle comes out, the drinking starts, and people start singing Barbershop Quartet, and they drag you, get in here, Bill Rogan's gold, and it's just like, I grew up with this sense of festivity at the core of my life. And everything that I associated with drinking from a young age was fun. It was fun. It looked like fun. It sounded like fun. And it never occurred to me until much later what a nightmare drinking can become for people. So, with that in mind, pick up a bottle at some point in my life, start drinking, and like anybody in here, there was that shell, that something that kept me locked inside, and I drank, and all of a sudden, shit, I'm Casanova, I'm Frank Sinatra. I mean, it's just that I'm full of myself, and probably everybody thought I was an asshole. I don't know, but I was unleashed. And I love that. I love that feeling. I'm from the 60s, and I probably would have arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous a lot earlier, except that I took that psychedelic sidebar, and that was really at the core of my of my spiritual trajectory as a young man was it was all about mind expansion, you know, self-enlightenment, awakening. And I'm here to tell you that there's a real part of that, you know. I really firmly believe that all religion started with somebody who picked something and went, holy shit, you know. The thing was that, you know, wiser people than me went, well, now I've seen light, I've seen the path, now I need to find a way to do that from inside here. For me, it was just, you know, give me one more, you know, but that was really the kind of the thrust of my life experience. And it was as if, you know, there was alcohol back here, you know, somewhere. You know, when I first got sober, I'm looking back and I'm thinking, well, when did I really start drinking? And I'm thinking, well, when did it get out of control? And I'm thinking, oh, you know, 29, 30, and then it kept going back. And then finally I realized the first time I really lit into a bottle, I was 12 years old. We got a bottle of whiskey. We moved out here from the East Coast when I was fairly young. I was living in Villa Park. They were always building a new development up the road. Some people had moved in. We got friendly with these kids. They were a little bit older. They got a bottle of bourbon, and we lit into it. And everybody's having a grand time. And within, you know, a matter of a half an hour, I'm on the counter, in the kitchen counter, with my head in the sink, puking my guts out. And that was the first time I ever really got serious about drinking. And it took me probably 2 or 3 years in sobriety to get back from, you know, well, I kind of had a problem at 30, maybe, you know, 28, 20, and until I realized, God, the first time I picked up a drink, I was an alcoholic, you know, but that was, you know, this train, you know, coming, you know, back here from somewhere in my past. And the whole psychedelic thing from the 60s, you know, and I'm out here, and somewhere along the line, this train lapped this one, you know. And it was, you know, and sometime, you know, 28, 29, 30, you know, I came to realize that the booze was paramount in my life. I was able to, even though I wasn't prepared to come in here quite yet, I became aware that it was a bit odd that I got up and had a beer for breakfast. You know, thought, maybe that isn't quite normal, you know. I got up to have a beer and then started playing my guitar and was going to write a song. And I had inspiration, I had purpose and everything. But, you know, that just, you know, I think all of us have this experience. We come in here and we start looking at our lives and realize that all the experiences we had, we just pictured everybody was like us. And then you get sober and you realize, oh, most people are just, they have a little wine and they leave half of it in the glass and walk away. And you're like, you're not going to leave that, are you? You know, And so, you know, that, you know, somewhere along the line, you know, that whole, you know, psychedelic journey, mind expansion journey, everything, that booze train lapped it big time. And so now, you know, I'm starting to have all the experiences that we've read. I was so fortunate. I had 2 502s in 1980, and it was like that in 1980. I got a couple of hundred hours of community service or $400. I was so screwed up in my life that I didn't do the community service. I didn't pay the money. I went to get an extension. The judge laughed at me and put me in cuffs and told me, you're not leaving here until you pay up. And you know, that was like, you know, the height of, you know, that was my the nature of my irresponsibility, you know, so indicative of what I was when I got here. But you know, I had a brother, Denny, and one of the really ironic things about my life, I had moved here in 78, and I was living on top of the old Schultz Pharmacy building, which was in the corner of Del Mar. It would be the southwest corner. So if you turn right onto Del Mar, it'd be on your left. And there's a door there, 91 Del Mar, and if you went up the stairs, and there were offices up there, and that's where the original Friendship Center was. And I was right across the hallway. I mean, I was from here to that wall back there from the solution, and I had no idea what the hell it was. And years later, I was talking to Larry Kane, and I told him I said, you know, remember the guy across the room? The guitar, you know, the whole room was filled with band equipment. We're in there rocking and rolling night and day. And you open the door and the marijuana smoke spills out, right? And every once in a while we get a little, I go to open the door, yeah, and the marijuana spills out and some of the ladies in there, do you know where the Alano Club is? You know, and I didn't know. I said, I think it's over there. I had no idea. They had an atrium in front with some plants in it, so you had to go through a door to get to the door. And so it was a little secretive. But it was, you know, all I remember was there was that sign, that the circle, the triangle, and then one day they disappeared. Anyway, I'm up there one day, and there's a knock on my door. I was actually going to a recording session. I walk out, and my brother Danny is standing out there. He was so screwed up, I didn't know who he was. And he's 10 years older than me, excuse me. And he was like a god to me when I was growing up. I couldn't recognize him. He'd been in a treatment center out in Indio. He got out. He somehow got arrested in Riverside. Then he tumbled down from Riverside through the weeds, had puke and weeds and shit on his coat. And he had a curly hair, and it was like an afro. And he's standing there looking at me, like, you know. And I didn't even recognize my own brother. He actually went through Casa del Cerro. Used to be on the hill up there in Dana Point, overlooking the harbor. And he went through there. And through that experience, I got introduced to the concept. You know, I was like, the thing is starting to seep in. There's a solution. There's a solution. There's some answer to this problem. But I was in that place where I, you know, no way in the world was I an alcoholic. And I, you know, and a large part of that I came to recognize was the absolute refusal to ask for help and accept help. I could do it on my own, God damn it, you know. And so that was like that barrier that was standing in front of me for the next 7 years. Well, from 1980 to 1985 were those hellish years for me, where I knew that it was not working and I didn't know how to stop. I wasn't willing to stop. And I, you know, my heart goes out to anybody who's in that place. Mark Twain once famously said about smoking, I have no problem, I've done it 100 times. And that's where I was with booze. You know, I could quit. It's staying quit, you know. And for me, that came to that understanding of the obsession of the mind. You know, it's over time, and you get away from this, the active alcoholism, and you're in recovery, and you recognize how little of the craving there is. It's all about the obsession, and it discusses that in, you know, pages 22-27 roughly in the big book, you know, that therefore our problems we find are centered in our mind, not our bodies. I was hanging on the bus for about a year, 1984. And I crash landed. The last throes of my disease. I'm in the Algodon Motel. I was proud. I had the place up and back overlooking the Arroyo. Thank you. It was always like, I didn't quite have the rent, I'll get to the rest next Friday, and you know, it's always something, and it's like $100 a week, and it was like you'd look and go, if I give them the whole rent, I won't have money for booze. And so anyway, I wrecked my motorcycle on 4th of July 1985, and it was just, everything was crumbling in on me. And you know, I'd have to get up in the morning and drink a beer and then throw it up on my feet in the shower, you know, have another one until I got out of the shower, and then go to work and have a jug of cranberry juice with vodka in it that I would drink all day at the job site, you know. And somehow in all, one way or another in all of that, you know, I finally got to a point of honesty and a willingness to ask for help. And we were talking with Fred about this guy, the Ranger, we used to call him, out the old Friendship Center, and he's wet brain, and you know, he'd sit out in front of this old Friendship Center, and I'd see him and see there, you know, and this is that terminal uniqueness where I'd see him and say, oh, that's, I can't be an alcoholic, that's an alcoholic, you know, So I'm like looking through the meeting guide, calling, you know, anything that, but to go to the Friendship Center, and they send me over to Pines Park. So I go there, and for the first time, I raised my hand and said, "Gary, I'm a newcomer," and I had been going to meetings late, leaving early, and then going home and feeling sorry for myself because nobody knew me. And the minute I identified and put my hand up and asked for help, I was surrounded by love. I was surrounded by caring. And the first thing he said to me was, "Gary, you've got to come down to the Friendship Center." I've been trying to avoid that place for a year, you know. And I was just so sure that there was something wrong. And, you know, and so anyway, so I ended up at the Friendship Center. The funny thing is, the Ranger, I was tripping at MacArthur Park in 1969, hand to God. And the Ranger was passing out what amounted to, if you ever read Bronner's peppermint soap, you know, and read the label, and it's all this weird, you know, religious stuff and everything. Well, he had all these flyers he's passing out that was like, it was like he had Xeroxed a copy of the label, and he was passing them out. And one day I'm in the meeting looking at this guy, and I realized, holy shit, this guy was passed. I remember him from the 60s, and he was a weird guy. I mean, you know, you couldn't understand a thing he said, you didn't know when he stopped, you for sure if he was done, you know, and then so there'd be a smattering of applause, and okay, next. And you know, what I realized very quickly was, wow, that's the ghost of alcoholism future. You know, that's what's waiting for me if I keep drinking. And, you know, and that night that I sit out there and I ask for this guy, Bob, to be my, you know, well, I asked him about sponsorship, and all of a sudden I'm being dragged in, you know, and I'm, well, wait, you know, this is going way too fast for me. And you know, I had made that initial surrender. I remember darkening the doors of my parents' place. My mother knocks. I knock on the door. My mother opens it. She looks at me, shaking her head, and says, "Mom, I'm an alcoholic." And that was like, you know, that essential element of our program of recovery. That, you know, it's not enough to admit it to myself. It's not even enough to admit it to God. I have to admit it to you. I have to, you know, and the old sense of the tribe where we sit around and we, you know, we tell our stories and we confess our sins. I had to get the stuff out of me and out in the open. And that was the only way I was going to be free. So, you know, I did all the things you were supposed to do. I took the, now, you know, it's just hard figuring out when to get sober, isn't it? You know, I mean, damn it. You know, there's, you know, it's like the holidays. Well, it's a kind of a lousy time and, you know, and you know, so there's always that 4th of July is coming up. I don't know, Labor Day. And so, but I, you know, I wasn't thinking anything, but, oh, I got to stop. You know, I'm killing myself. You know, I'm terrified. I don't know how to go on sober. I mean, you know, with drinking, I don't know how to go on without drinking. So I show up here and I started doing everything that people told me to do. I mean, right down to cleaning ashtray, setting up. I ended up cooking the Thanksgiving turkey for the club down there on Los Molinos. I cooked the Christmas turkey. I took commitments. I was the secretary of that Sunday morning meeting. Larry started that 7:30 Sunday meeting so they could get home in time for football, he told me. And I went out of my own money. I bought 3 or 4 dozen donuts. I got Starbucks coffee. The place was packed. You know, and people come in and say, you know, Gary, the old timers say, this is an expression of your sobriety. You know, I had done all the things, you know, in the Philistine fashion. I'd done all the things that expected of you. But I really didn't think that I was done. And I didn't even know that I didn't think I was done. And one of the most critical things lessons that I learned from this experience of being sober, going on 19, 20 months, and going out and coming back, is not to keep secrets. And there was a guy at the time at the club that was a 30-day wonder. He was always, you know, like he had 30 days or 31 days or 20 days or, you know, 35 days. He was always in and out, in and out. And he's always sharing. He always had all the wisdom in the world. And at some point, he was sitting there going on and on and on and on. And he says, you know, by the way, are there any newcomers in here? And someone in the back goes, yeah, you. That shut him up like a clam. But, you know, the thing is, I bring this guy up because he shared a meeting. I had been thinking for months about having a drink. I'd let the obsession start to work in my mind and fester, and it grows. And I think of Dr. Paul and what he used to share about, you know, gee, then I just noticed this little problem. And good thing I noticed it because, you know, boy, if I hadn't noticed this problem, you know, it might have gotten away, you know. And how we can turn little things into big things. And you know, I just kept obsessing about this drink and obsessing about this drink. And here's this guy that I just hated listening to him. And, you know, he says, you know, you're only as sick as your secrets. And it was like a knife in my heart because I knew he was talking the truth. And the thing I know today is that somebody could have 6 days and open their mouth and share something, and that person is sponsoring me today because they say exactly what I need to hear. And I hear it because I'm here for good. And there aren't any shortcuts. There's no getting, you know, there's no end arounds. And I need answers. I need information. I need truth. I don't ever want to drink again. Anyway, I ended up going out, and the thing about going out is that you invariably tell yourself, no problem, I'm going to control this. If it doesn't work, and I was really, you know, that was my mindset, was that, well, if give it 2-3 weeks, and if I can't drink like a gentleman, I'll come right back in. 6 months later, I'm lying in that jail cell in San Quintin with the Mexicans. And bueno, going away a mile a minute, and I'm detoxing, and I just want to shut the fuck up, you know, and you know, it's driving me mad, and I'm starting to retch, and I'm aware that I may have killed somebody. I don't know. I have no idea what happened. I just know that I'm vaguely aware that I had this accident. You know, I'm bloody and bruised And this is my story, and I don't say this because it's right or wrong. I say it because it's true for me. But Ed P., one of the founders of the Friendship Center with Larry Kane and their two wives, I used to see him walking around San Clemente. And, you know, if most of you probably don't know him, but, you know, 6'5", big man, 300 pounds. He had a road map for a face. I used to feel so sorry for that guy, 27, 28 years old. I'd see him, you know, me, you know, not prior to my life. I'd see him and think, wow, that poor son of a bitch. You know, I figured he was an alcoholic. Well, he was, you know, except for recovering one. So I meet him in Alcoholics Anonymous. The first thing that Ed ever said to me was, bad news, Bob. I don't know if you remember him, but, you know, everybody came in, he'd go, yeah, I know your type. You're not going to stay sober. You know, I can see it all. It's written all over you. You know, and Ed comes up to me and he goes, Gary, don't listen to him. That's bad news, Bob. And he gets from Ed gets in my face, and you got to remember, you know, you're new, you're scared, you don't know what the hell's going on. And he says, you know, Gary, everything is exactly the way it's supposed to be right now. And I'm looking up at Ed's face. You know, it looked like hamburger. His piercing blue eyes. A couple of sprigs on his head, hairs on his head, and I'm thinking, this is can't be the way it's supposed to be right now. No. You know, and it was. It was exactly what it was supposed to be right now. And it always is. And but I remember sitting behind him in a meeting one time, and he said, and this is his share. And he said, you know, the last time I had a drink, the last time I got in trouble, he said, I promised my God I would never take another drink the rest of my life. So help me God, one day at a time. And I remember thinking at the time, I couldn't say that. And that's when I knew that, gee, you know, that obsession hadn't really been lifted from me. And I believe that you can walk through that today, but I wasn't ready to walk through it. I needed to crash my car down in San Quintín, you know. No, I didn't, but that's where I ended up. And lying there, and I remember that those words from Ed, and that was what was in my heart. And, you know, it wasn't like, well, gee, I think this is next on the list. It just came to me. And I said, you know, God, I don't care if I've killed somebody. This isn't you're hugging the porcelain steering wheel bargain, you know, where if you get me out of this one, you know. There was no bargain anymore. It was just, I don't care. If I have to spend the next 25 years of my life in prison, I don't care. I don't want to ever be here again. I don't want to ever do this again, you know. And I made that promise. And I got back here, one of the first things I thought was, and as I, you know, sobered up, you know, it took me 3 days to get out of that mess and get back up here. And the first things I thought was, maybe I went a little overboard on that one. And then I start thinking, but if there's a God, then, you know, somebody's listening, you know, and I'm really screwed if I try to back out of this deal, you know. And then, and you know, if there isn't a God, then I'm really screwed. You know, it's because, you know, what's my life without a God? So, you know, I was ready to go get another six pack, and I walk in the old Alpha Beta in the south end of town, and one of the gals from the Friendship Center walks out. She worked there. She was packing the cooler. She goes, "Gary, we miss you. You got to come back to the club." And so I went back there, and that day, you know, I mean, you walked into the store and the beer was right here. I was ready to walk down there and grab a six. Wow, what's one more six pack, you know? And always still thinking that, you know, that I could control the drink once I took it, you know. And so, but I went to a meeting instead, and I was sitting there, and I was ready to go to the mall, buy something, come out with my hands full of stuff, and go, "Where's my car? Report it missing." So I could collect the money, because I couldn't stand the idea that I had this brand new car that I had to pay for the next 5 years, and I don't have the car. And I'm sitting in that meeting, and all of a sudden the thing about honesty and integrity and the core principles of this program just rose up, and they passed through me, and I know for a fact I'm going to tell a fib somewhere along the way, but I just can't start a lifetime of sobriety on a big fat fib. So I made a commitment that it didn't matter. You know, I thought, well, if I spend $10 a day to stay sober, what's that? Because if I'm not sober, I'm in San Quintín lying in a jail cell. So it's $10 a day for the next 5 years for me to have live a sober life. I go home, and the guy that was my agent called me and goes, "You got AAA, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "You're covered. All I had to do is go haul the thing back up there, up here." You know, and that was going to be true anyway, but it was just for me, it was like the minute I got honest, you know, and then this thing happened and it all fell together. I ended up dragging the thing back up here and they totaled it out, and I walked away with a brand new truck. And I was prepared for my life to be miserable. If you're new today and you're struggling with the idea, as Ed used to say, is the bottle whistling at you? You know, if that desire to have a drink is working in your head, I know the feeling, and I was terrified that was what was going to happen. I was going to come up here and I was going to struggle. I was going to be, you know, just hanging on for dear life. And whatever it was that happened in that jail cell, you know, we talk about that moment of clarity, you know, a surrender, whatever happened, I got back up here and I was free. The obsession to drink had been lifted from me, and you know, every day of my life I remember that. Every day of my life, it's core to you know, my peace and serenity. That I basically said, "Here, help." And if you listen, if you read the book and you listen to chapter 5, the portion of chapter 5 we read, and really listen carefully, and you look at the first step, and it says, you know, that my life is unmanageable. It's like there isn't a half measure on this one thing alone. You know, it's like either we really trust in God, we got our hands in the steering wheel. And you know, here 26 years later, I can look back and every time my life starts to get screwed up, it's because I start to take control again. So it's part of my continuing enlightenment over the course of my sobriety is this realization that, you know, it's just half measures availed us nothing. And it later says that none of us can do this perfectly, right? And so for me, that half measure is that surrender. That, you know, for me, that moment in that jail cell when I just gave it up, you know, I said, I'm done. And a sense of freedom was given to me from the obsession to drink. You know, and that I got back here and, you know, it's life is hard. I don't know, maybe it isn't for you. But, you know, it's like, I used to, my life was so screwed up before because all I could think about was me and worry about me. Now, I look at the world and sometimes I just think too much about all the problems and all the worries in this world. And that gets me screwed up. But, you know, I at every step of my life, I have to accept and surrender that I have no control. And you know, again, if you can point out to me somewhere in the big book or somewhere in the steps where it says that my, you know, once admitting that my life is unmanageable, that it actually becomes manageable again, I'd like to see you after the meeting because I haven't been able to find that place. You know, my life is unmanageable. And you know, the secret of living for me every day is like, How in the world do I can't just sit still and do nothing, you know? And so what's the, you know, the difference between, you know, being getting into action and not being in control? And, you know, like this thing with Amazon when I was talking to them the other day, you know, this is so indicative for me of my disease. That, you know, the first thing that comes to me is escalation and war. As an alcoholic, you know, my first thought is to start a fight, you know. And so I'm constantly struggling with that urge in my life. And you know, the steps is, you know, where I keep coming back to the principles in this program. You know, I'm just like this impulsive little kid, you know, it has to be constantly tamed. And so, you know, I'm so blessed, you know, to have found sobriety. It's just a constant challenge for me every single day. And, you know, and I think of somebody who's just walked in here, is struggling, is new. You know, I just when I got back here from that accident, and I realized that I had been relieved of the obsession to drink, I had this profound desire to somehow bottle that and hand it to somebody and say, here, you know, you don't ever have to take another drink the rest of your life. And you know, I'm humbled by this simple truth that is expressed in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that no human power could have relieved my alcoholism, that God couldn't, would if he were sought. And, you know, and so, you know, I'm left to be a servant and hope that somehow or another, by being involved in this program, participating in it, you know, by accident, you know, I might say something that turns on a light for somebody else, the way the old timers turned on a light for me at some point in my life, and the course of my sobriety. You know, this town has a really special place for me. Surely you meet some of us who trudge this road of happy destiny. And you know, as I've traveled around the country and I've traveled around the world, and I see everywhere I go that if you got sober in Laguna, you know, that's really a really special place for you. If you got sober in Carmel or you got sober in wherever. And so, you know, I got sober in this town. And even though there aren't a lot of familiar faces out there tonight, you know, this is where it all started for me. I can see it like it was yesterday, standing out there asking that guy, Bob, to be my sponsor. And I was listening to the reading tonight, thinking, you know, none of us claim to do this perfectly, and you know, I'm being able to acknowledge that, you know, has really kept me humble over the years. I'm just, so deeply flawed, but, you know, there's that one thing that I do perfectly, and that's not take a drink. Part of the story, 11 years ago, a little over 11 years ago, I was sitting in this very room holding memorial service for my brother Denny, the one who came and knocked on my door in 1978. And, he had 9 years sober, and, he hadn't been paying that insurance policy. He hadn't been going to meetings. He hadn't been participating. And he got in some difficult situations, and he picked up a drink. And 2 weeks later, he was gone from this earth. And, somewhere back in time, this room was filled with his friends. He was really a people person. And something like 200 people showed up for his memorial service. When he passed away, it was just one more renewal for me in this program that if he had been going to meetings, he probably would have been okay. I get to the point where, I'm so comfortable in my own skin at times that I just as soon sit around. If Mike had invited me to come here to speak, I might well have been sitting at home tonight trying to work. Every day, every time I feel like being selfish, I think of that. 2 years later, I buried my other brother from this disease. And it's just a reminder every single day that I need to participate in my recovery. When I got back from that accident in Mexico, I really wanted so much to be able to pass on that freedom, and I realized that all I have to offer is just to be here and to participate in this program. If you're new, welcome to the tribe. That's what I've learned, is that it's ingrained in our nature for millions of years, and we're so blessed to have a place to come to. And I'm struck every day by the very sheer miracle that this program exists. It's really been a pleasure being here tonight and sharing with you. And thank you for my sobriety.